G'day, folks. Talk to James Parr, fella from down Victoria way. He's got an acquired disability due to cancer, traumatic loss of a limb, and jump into his traumatic past growing up. But that hasn't stopped him, where he's moving forward with health and fitness, CrossFit, pursuing triathlons with the goal of the Paralympics. And he's even a model. He doesn't muck around. And folks, he's trying to find his Aboriginality as a Wiradjuri man. So if anybody's out there that hears this and can help him find family connections, that'd be great. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe button. Be much appreciated. And we've also got a Patreon page. The link is within the description. Click on that. Check it out. If you want to become a part of the squad, that'd be awesome. And want to thank our sponsors, Permbill Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here. And they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, let's get into it.
Keep rolling with Jake Briggs.
Brother, James Parr, thanks for jumping on board the podcast and having a yarn with us, mate. Much appreciated.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
Too easy. So, brother, your mob. Where's your mob from?
Now, I always say it wrong. So every time I say it, because like I need to like chunk it, give me two seconds. But it's like war. And the amount of times I've heard it, I always will continue to say it wrong. So I'm currently on Yorta Yorta.
Yorta Yorta, yeah. So down south in Victoria.
Yeah, yep.
Yep.
Then I am... Wiradjuri. I can't say it properly.
Hey, you're from the Wiradjuri mob.
Yeah.
Wiradjuri. Yeah, right.
Yeah, every time. Yeah.
So, Wiradjuri, if you can see, like, because this is a First Nations map behind me, you can see where my fist is right there, that brown, massive, light brown, massive area.
Yeah.
Because Wiradjuri are one of the largest tribes in not just New South Wales, but bloody Australia.
Yeah, down through, Hayen, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, pretty big mob.
Yeah.
And, so that's awesome, huh? So... Do you ever get back out on country?
I do. Like, I live in the country, and there's a lot of people that I've, connected with, especially, through schooling and stuff. So, yes, but I haven't really been back down to, my mob, where that's from, or really gone that deep into it, because I don't really have any real connections. My grandfather... I can't think of the right word, but he really just refused to be a part of the Aboriginal community and his identity. So to try and navigate through that and find out our own sort of family tree or history and our culture has been really difficult.
Yeah, okay. Well, was he a bit shamed out or something, or what was going on there?
I actually can't tell you because I have no idea.
Yeah,
I don't have any communication with that. I don't talk to my father or his grandfather or anything, so I don't really have any communication there. But I have no idea. I think maybe he was shunned upon. But when you look at them, say visually and physically, you can tell. So I'm not sure why. Yeah, I can't answer that.
Well, brother, hopefully. You know, if some mob out there can, if they're listening to this, hopefully they reach out, you know, because that's what it's all about, you know, making connections. And if it's finding out, you know, the rich culture within the Wiradjuri mob, and, you know, if it's finding out more about the mob itself and just Aboriginality, and if that helps in any way, that's, you know, it's all about growth. And well, the thing is too, brother, you know, like a lot of, it's all about, you know, reclaiming and just looking far into the depths of Aboriginality, because a lot was, you know, what was lost. And when you're talking about the stolen generation and just, you know, people getting taken off country and just how that's disrupted us as a First Nations people across this continent. So
yeah, I can now connecting with it a lot more and sort of finding, you know, a bit more of the roots and all that sort of stuff, I can see how that intergenerational trauma has affected my family.
Mm.
And even though, like, for instance, refusing to be part or identify as Aboriginal for a start, but even just like how it impacts and affects the family and how that sort of, how that's gone out through generations without actually realizing it, I guess.
Yeah, okay. And yeah, so down on country on Yorta Yorta, hey, I know that's, you know, where Briggs, the Aboriginal rapper, he's from down that way. He's part of the Yorta Yorta, Yorta Yorta mob. Yep. I've got the same last name, but I don't know if related, but who knows. Probably. That. He's got some solid tunes, bro. That's actually that's a flag of that represents AB Original, his band that he's got with Trials.
Yeah, cool.
I saw him support Body Count. So, you know, Ice-T, you know, the rapper?
Yeah, I think so.
But that's his hardcore band. So
right.
I saw him at Luna Park because I'm, you know, right into, you know, hardcore rap, heavy metal, all that sort of stuff. So,
that's cool.
Yeah, but mate, you've gone through some significant changes in your young life, pretty significant traumatic changes. And when it's got to do with, you know, cancer and, you know, amputation and all of that, which is, you know, pretty full on for a young fellow like yourself. And it's good to see, you know, that you're putting it out there. And when it's got to do with social media, just when it's got to do, you know, with the amputation and cancer and what that represents. But also what I've seen, brother, a lot where you've talked about, you know, when it's got to do with your adverse, you know, childhood.
Yeah.
And if we reel it a bit back to where that all began, and obviously that's, you know, what it shaped, you know, who you are. Yeah, so can we touch on a bit about that, mate, if that's all right?
Yeah, we can touch on everything. So I grew up in Deniliquin with my mum and my father. I was the only one between them, but they both had two older siblings from a previous relationship. So they had two each, and then there was me. And so my mum died when I was 8. She had cancer. So she had lung cancer, and basically, so she had been having chemo, and it really affected her, and it basically she just chose to not keep going further with it. And so she died at home when I was 7 or 8, and so that and then I lived with my father for maybe another 4 years. And I was probably, so it would have been about 12. So we lived in, by then we lived in Chukaramoama. And my dad had another 2 kids, and I actually ran away from my dad.
How old were you when you ran away?
12.
Jeez, right.
Yeah. So my dad was quite violent, physically, verbally, and he was affected by drugs, and there was just like a lot going on, and I had sort of worked up the courage for quite some time, and I just thought, stuff it. So one day I literally just packed a bag. I went down at the end of my street. There was a telephone box. So I called 1-800-REVERSE and I called my dad, and I was like, I've just ran away. Can you come and get me? And she's like, what? I was like, just come and get me. So she come and got me. And she come and got me, and then organized to go and live with my auntie and uncle. And my auntie was also from my father's side, so my dad's sister, obviously. And so I started living with them, and I ended up having to get an intervention order. It was my choice, on my father, just because
that's pretty full on. Yeah,
it was. And I guess by then I sort of just had enough, and I wanted to probably just cut all connections and not feel, still continue to feel dragged down out of, by a situation that I was out of. And I wanted to take control of that situation. I didn't want to be, you know, not in control. So yeah, I decided to get an intervention order on my dad.
But that's pretty big steps for a young fella too, like at that age, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was. I mean, at the time it was just like happening, but now when I look back, I think the same, like, shit, like, I did all that. Or even when I tell it to other people. And then I lived with my auntie and uncle until I was 18. And then I moved out with friends. And yeah, so that was my childhood.
Yeah, okay. So then they were looking after you until you were a legal adult. So
yeah.
That whole process. So were you, and you were saying, you say you don't have, currently you don't have contact with your father now? Yeah. Okay.
Since then, really. So it's been about 10 years. We've made
so you haven't spoken to him really since that intervention order?
No, not once. So he was living in Echuca at the time. So the court that we had actually had to go to get that intervention order.
And where's that?
In Echuca.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's still along the Murray.
So, right, okay.
It's the border town. So Moham is New South Wales. Echuca's Victoria.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, you don't know where that is?
yeah, not familiar with exactly where that is. I know Deniliquin.
Yeah, so it's probably about an hour away from Deniliquin.
Yeah, okay.
And yeah, so he had actually seen us in the town that day, me and my auntie. And he called my auntie, and he wasn't aware of what we were doing. And he called my auntie and he just said, hey, can I talk to you? And she was pretty chill. So she's like, yeah, no worries. And he whispered in her ear, if you want James, you can have him. I'll take you to the bank and you can give me money and I'll sign you over James.
Hold on. Was she being serious?
That serious, yeah.
All right, let's, cash me up and then I'll give you your son back, pretty much.
Pretty much, yeah. He wanted, I'm not sure what the amount was or why he, don't know, but because it happened across the road. So I was like at like some cafe with my nan and I saw him like whisper something in her ear and she just pretty much said F off and turned around and come back.
But what was the reason of that? Like if she's talking about handing you over for cash, did she not give it? Really care about you or what's
the go? Well, it was him doing that. It was him asking that.
Oh, right.
It was my father saying to her, you can have James if you want him, but I'll take you to the bank and you can give me some money.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. So then he caused a bit of a scene in the main street after she just walked away from him. And then the following day, we went to the court and we got the intervention order placed. And that was really the last time I had probably any interaction with him until maybe about 4 years ago. I was just at my sister's house. So he still has children. Like we have the same dad and he's still in contact with them. And so I was at my sister's house and there was a knock on the door. And he was there, so I just like went out the back and just got in my car and we made eye contact, and that's really all we've had.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Full on. Mate, traumatic for yourself as a young fella and just hearing that when it's got to do with, you know, you, it's like, you know, self-worth. Like you're probably like looking back on that and it's like, you know, what am I worth? Like what were you thinking that? Like when they're talking about you just as a commodity, not as a person. Yet, yeah. What's the monetary amount on James like to flood out? You know,
I guess when I was younger, I didn't really, in some way, I wasn't surprised. Because I guess to me, it was like my father never actually really cared. And I don't know, I guess maybe for a while I had probably, leading up to me running away and leaving and doing that sort of stuff, I probably had lost that emotional attachment to my father already. So I guess back then it was like, I laughed, like I was like, oh, like, I don't know. And not really thinking about it. But now looking back on it, I guess not even just that and looking at it as like he wanted money for me or from me and that sort of stuff, I guess I can see how it has affected me and those sort of things that I probably do in everyday life now as a result. But I think being fully aware of it and understanding how it has affected me, I can make adjustments. And sort of
so how does it, so overall, and you know, it's a, you know, it's a big one to sort of really pinpoint down, but like how has that shaped you as an adult? Because that's a pretty significant effect on a young person, and obviously that's gonna, you know, add to depth of, you know, who you are today. So how's that shaped you, you reckon?
I think it really made me such a resilient person, as well as being able to, again, know my worth and where I sort of stand in this world or in, you know, just even in relationships or with my family. Because over time, I never had, again, as well, a different sort of thing, but I never really had a voice and I was never, I would never stand up for myself or anything like that. And I was always, everything was out of my control. So it was now as an adult, I make sure that everything is in my control as much as I can, not in like a controlling way, but more so of like, yeah, I don't know. What sort of way, but not a controlling way, but more so that, yeah, I know my worth and if I want something, I'll do it, or I'll do everything to sort of control my environment and the people that I'm with, and making sure that, you know, I have good friends and good family surrounded by me.
Yeah, it's very important. And that's it.
Yeah.
It's, you know, having the right people around you, and, you know, and it's always tricky with, obviously with family, because you can't choose them. They are who they are. And
yeah,
it's just trying to balance that out. And, you know, obviously, you know, keeping your physical and mental health as, you know, as balanced as can be, and, you know, and trying to live life as best as you can. So
yeah,
brother, cancer, no joke.
Yeah.
That's hit you pretty hard and heavy. And obviously as a young person, before it's a, you know, physically affected you to what led to your amputation, but, you know, back with your mum, which is very, very hard. But physically, how were you aware of it, the cancer?
Yeah. So it was basically, I worked at a special school at the time. And I remember one day, me and the kids were playing cricket. We had a plastic cricket bat, and this cricket, like plastic cricket bat, just brushed so softly the side of my ankle. I had fallen over, and I was just in a lot of pain in my ankle. I couldn't touch it, couldn't walk on it for at least a minute, and then I got back up and was fine. So that sort of really just alerted me to this sort of like, felt like a nerve pain. So I didn't think anything of it. It was like, sort of like, you know, when you hit your funny bone, sort of just like numbs your whole sort of. So it would numb my ankle. And that was the start of it. And that was where I was, I guess, alerted to some sort of pain. And I was quite active at the time. I was doing CrossFit every night and continually.
So how old were you when this happened?
2 years ago.
It was 2 years. So yeah. When you got Like when you copped it in the ankle and felt that pain,
that would have been 3 years ago. Yeah.
So that was 3 years ago. So yeah. You first felt that, and then you're like, oh, was
like the initial.
Okay, something's going on here.
Yeah. So again, I was very active. So I was doing a lot, and it just sort of, the pain was increasing. And so I went to the doctor. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause you would have felt like CrossFit when you're doing squats and all that sort of business. Yeah.
And running and like everything, it just sort of, but it would come at random times. So yeah, it was just like something again that I thought was just some sort of nerve pain, or I had no idea. Or maybe, and then I thought maybe I just like chipped the bone, but I was like, it's a plastic cricket bat and it literally just brushed. Like, and I couldn't touch it. So it was like on your ankle, do you have like that little, I don't know what it's called.
Are you talking about the bone or the Achilles? Yeah, or
the bone on the that side. Sits.
Yeah, right.
It was there. So if I touched that, it would just, it was like this weird feeling, and it would sort of like numb my ankle. So even
could
and
could you physically see anything on the outside? No. Was it red or anything like that? No.
No, physically nothing. So then I went to the doctor and I just told her, and I think I got an x-ray and an ultrasound, and so she just diagnosed me, well, said it was a calcified ligament. So she's like, not much we can do, we just have to sort of push through it. So I was, and then I was like, I can't do this anymore. Like something, there must be something we can do to sort of fix it. Cause then it was starting to like increase, and it would happen. I'd take Panadol and stuff, and then 4 hours later it would start happening, or I'd wake up during the middle of the night and I'd have that pain there, and I'd say take Panadol. It would take an hour for that to actually like kick in and sort of numb it, to be able to even go back to sleep. So so I went back, and then she transferred me, put me with a trauma specialist, and so I went to him, had some further scans. Then he diagnosed me with an osteoid, which is a bone tumor that is generally benign. And
a bone tumor.
Yeah.
Right. So like a mass that sits on the bone itself.
In the bone. Internally.
Okay.
Yeah. And it was probably at that stage, it was probably like 5 millimeters. Like it was nothing. It was very small. Mm-hmm. So I did have a biopsy then as well, but further down the track, we figured out in that biopsy, they pulled from the wrong spot. So it did come back benign. And then I was on a waiting list for 10 months to have it removed. And
while these 10 months, while that thing's growing.
Yeah. Like if we had it, exactly. And while it was growing in that 10 months, like the pain was like significantly worse. Like,
could you walk?
I could, but I was living off Panadol and ibuprofen every 4 hours. I'd wake up during the night, and I'd wake up and just this night sweat, and my bed would be drenched. And like, it was pretty shit. And then
that is pretty shit.
Yeah. Then got to 10 months and my nan was the one like pushing me. She's like, you need to like keep going back. And I did, I kept going back and I kept saying, I can't walk. I have to take this every 4 hours. Like it must be like, I need to get this fixed. So at the end of the 10 months, I was like, stuff it. I elected to go as a private patient and paid $5,000 to have the procedure done. So the procedure was just a day procedure. It was a CT guided procedure, because what they would do is they would put a needle into the middle of the tumor, heat it to 9 degrees, leave it in there for 6 minutes, and then it would sort of just kill it, pull it out, done.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So the surgeon was like, you'll have instant relief. You'll get back up and walk again. You'll be fine. I was like, oh, great. So, I actually booked tickets to go to Sydney straight after I had that done.
Because you're thinking you're going to be sweet, pain's gone, righto, let's jump on a plane. Let's
I still went, but I was in pain.
Oh, did you? Yeah.
And so...
So no relief?
No. So I had the procedure done. Right. Nothing was said to me. Went to Sydney. And then the following week on a Tuesday, they said the nurse would call me and check in and see how it was going. So she called me, I think, on the Tuesday, and she said, oh, how's it going? I'm like, mate, I'm in so much pain. Ever since that's happened, I was like, it is killing. Like, it's worse. She's like, oh, that's weird. I'll get the surgeon to call you. So he called me on Wednesday, the day after, or maybe a couple of hours later. And he said, you know, it was a CT-guided procedure. I didn't suspect that this was going to happen. He's like, when I got the image up, I knew straight away that it wasn't an osteoid, and that...
So was that before he went in and took?
Before he went in and did it.
So then he knew.
So he knew, yeah.
Right.
Then he goes, so I pulled some more samples and did some more biopsies. By the way, he sent me a bill a month after for $1,000 for a private biopsy. I'm like, I didn't consent to that. I'm not paying that. You could have told me. Anyway.
Yeah, it's nice. $1,000 later.
Yeah. Anyway, pulled some more samples, and it is exactly what I thought. And he's like, so I did go ahead and do the procedure because that's what we were there for.
Mm.
He goes, but it is what I thought it was, and you actually have osteosarcoma. I was like, okay. And he goes, which is cancerous. I was like, oh shit. Okay. And yeah, so basically got me down the week after. I started chemo for 3 months. So I was on a 12-month chemo program. In the first 3 months, their plan of attack was to, and it was small, so it was like a centimeter, I think, mm-hmm. at that stage. And so it's pretty small.
Still a lot of pain.
Yeah, horrible. We'll do, chemo for 3 months. That will sort of kill it. And then we'll just go in and do a bone graft, and then you'll have to continue chemo. It's quite aggressive. Yep, no worries. So then I started the chemo, and in that 3 months, like, the pain was just, it was uncontrollable in that 3 months. It got to the point where, you know, I remember there was one night I couldn't get to sleep because I was in so much pain. It was like 3 a.m. and I was in so much pain. I remember just lying in bed and crying. I couldn't move my body. If I moved my arm, it would like jolt it. If I moved my leg, it would like, I don't know. So then... And then it happened again at the hospital, and the same sort of thing, like they gave me, I think, morphine, fentanyl, everything, and nothing was like numbing that pain.
Jeez, pretty aggressive.
Yeah, there was like those two sort of, I guess, memories I have.
And, yeah. And what was the rest of your body feeling like being on chemo? Like, you would have had the pain, but were you physically feeling ill? Or like, what else was going on?
Yeah, so I had two different rounds of chemo. One was sort of like the really tough one that, you know, you lose your hair with, and that would really affect me, I think, for a week. So they would give me one lot, and then they'd give me another lot, and then I'd have a 3 week break. And so for 1 week, I can't explain it any other better way than I really just wanted, I was depressed for a week. Like heavily depressed. I would turn my phone off. I wouldn't talk to anyone. I would hide at home. I couldn't eat. So there was all of that while I had this pain during that 3 months of the first chemo. But once that week was sort of over, then I would come back to normal. So once I sort of knew that that was how it affected me, I would just like, all right, need to push through that week, then I'll return back to normal.
Mm.
I knew it wasn't me, and it wasn't how I actually felt. It was just how it affected me and my body each time I had that. that chemo. So at the end of the 3 months, they, you know, they do everything, do all the scans and stuff again. And amputation was never an option, and it was never sort of presented to me.
Right.
And yeah, I went into that appointment, and the surgeon was like,
the same surgeon that took that biopsy.
Yeah, because he actually was linked in with Peter McCallum down in Melbourne, and he did all the sarcoma operations. So,
You see, like a lead specialist when it's got to do with those types of operations.
And so, basically, what happened in that 3 months, chemo had the opposite effect, become more aggressive, and it grew around the whole ankle joint. And so he showed, I remember seeing the picture, and it had gone from like 1 centimeter to like 2 centimeters, and around the whole ankle joint, like it was bright red. So like it was ready to sort of go. And
that would have just been creep. That would have crept either down into your foot or up your leg. Yeah. Is that what it would do?
Yeah. So usually that type of cancer will jump up the limb, or it would go to any part of your body through the bone, or straight to your lungs. And if it goes to your lungs, well, you're done, basically.
Is there any correlation there, like with what your mom went through and to that, or no?
So a sarcoma, basically, like this doesn't come through hereditary. It's just when your bone is forming, the cells get muddled up, and it just turns into cancer. That's how that's formed, really. So I guess up until, you know,
that's hardcore, eh?
Yeah, 22 23, I was still growing, as I remember, still having growing pains, and that's also what I initially thought that was. So I guess that part of the bone,
yeah, because you seem like a tall fella. How tall are you?
6'4".
Yeah, I thought you'd be around that. Yeah,
yeah, but I'm missing a foot, so I think I'm 5 foot. Sorry, I have to. And
you got to throw that in there, brother.
I had to, as soon as you asked me, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, so he said there was two options, and basically, so the first option was to remove the ankle joint. Then that would take longer to organize that surgery.
Is that where you fuse it? Is that a fusion?
Yeah.
So
remove it, put a like a rod up the middle of my heel to hold those bones together. And I would have to like get plastic surgery, skin's contaminated, greater risk of the cancer coming back. And then I would have, which isn't a bad thing either, but I would have a limp for the rest of my life, because I can't move that ankle.
Right.
And that, or amputation. And then, so I, leading up to that appointment, I had actually already processed that it was going to happen. I don't know why, but especially that morning, I remember waking up just thinking, all right, he's gonna say amputation. And whenever you would Google that cancer or osteosarcoma, it always comes up amputation.
Yeah.
So
I know, because it's hard not to throw that into the Google search bar. And obviously you try not to Google doctor stuff, but you want to find out for yourself too. That's because sometimes doctors and surgeons, they won't, like, even if you're paying private and you want to ask them questions, like you feel like you're hurried through and you're not getting the right answers. But
that's right.
How did you feel about that with the medical staff and leading up to where before the amputation and just the information process? How was that for you?
Well, I did ask about the amputation, because I was like, whenever I Google comes up the amputation, they initially, because they were right though, initially they're like, no way, we don't have to do anything like that. It's very small. But in that first 3 months, I built up a very good relationship with, you know, my oncologist and that. So I did trust them and had a very good relationship with them. I guess looking back, there are like gray areas where I can think, okay, they could have done this and they should have done this and they should have done that.
Yeah.
You're going to do that, but no one's to blame. It is what it is. And again, I knew it was going to, I don't know, that day I just knew they were going to say amputation. So I remember sitting in their waiting room and I was Googling prosthetics and how, like how people walk with prosthetics. Like I was just Googling all this shit. And so when they told me, I was like, all right, cool. Yeah. And then, yeah, I just said to him, so when's it going to happen? Happened 5 days later. So.
Hold on. So you talked about it. Righto, yeah. This might be what the path that we're going down, amputation, getting a lop.
Yeah.
And bang, 5 days.
5 days, it was straight in.
And what's the preparation for you that you went through? So in that 5 days, and like medically, what was the preparation, but also mentally and physically for yourself?
Yeah, medically, there was no prep. Basically, I just rocked up the day before to the hospital. I had to stay in overnight just so they could monitor me and do everything. But that was the only sort of prep that they did. Yeah, that was all that they did.
Do they try and introduce like a psychologist or anything like that to sort of mentally prepare yourself with anything?
Yeah. So they said that they would do that. They didn't. But I guess I didn't need it, to be quite honest. I was okay. I accepted it. Mm. And I was, throughout the whole process, I was very fine. So I didn't need it. I reckon they would have if I pushed for it. But yeah, no. And I guess physically and mentally, I was on crutches at the time. I remember the second I got out of that appointment, I threw those crutches and I was like, stuff them. These are my last 5 days on two legs. I'm going to enjoy it. And, you know, even though it was pain and all that sort of stuff, I was like, I don't care. These are my last 5 days with two legs and I'm going to enjoy it. And sort of, you know, and, you know, mentally I did a lot of like just sort, well, not mentally, I think it was to protect myself mentally. I did a lot of research and reached out to probably a lot of amputees and
just sort of
to like scope how they went through it. And I felt okay the whole time. My family were probably more affected than I was. So like I called my sisters and I knew one would have broke down. So I'd called her. I called the other one and I said, I'm sorry, I'm just going to drop you with a bomb and I'll talk to you later. So I was like, but you need to go to my other sister's house and sort of deal with her because she's going to be a mess. And I was like, so just call me later. And she's like, what is it? I can get my leg chopped off next Tuesday. And she's like, what? I'm like, yeah, I'll talk to you later. Bye. Because I'm like, I just, you know, in sort of like, it was very new to me. Mm. And I guess I was still sort of in some sort of shock where I didn't think it was going to actually happen. And to process and take on other people's feelings and emotions, I didn't want to. And I knew it was going to be like that. But I also had to tell them. And that was difficult. They offered me, like in that appointment afterwards, they did offer me to go and talk to them. And I was fine. So I'm like, no, I'm fine. I messaged another sister and because she kept harassing me all day and was like, how'd it go? How'd it go? What happened? She kept trying to call me. And my first message to her was just, don't call me. I don't want to talk. Because I would have started crying just because it was like so raw and it was just very fragile.
Because you're fragile and, you know.
Fragile time.
Being open with family and obviously it's letting your emotions out.
Yeah, I actually was like, okay, it was just more so, you know, I can't deal with other people's emotions, especially my family. If someone starts crying, I start laughing. You know, so even to that sister, I was just like, don't call me, don't want to talk.
Mm.
I just put, I'm getting my foot chopped off next Tuesday. And I'm not kidding because I'm such a big joker. I'm not kidding. I'll talk to you this afternoon. So
just dropped that on a lap and said, see ya.
And one of the worst things that I did do was a week prior, my friend had asked me sort of like, you know, just checked in, one of my really good friends, how's it going? What's happening? What's the surgery? I was joking. And I I said, I'm like, oh, they're chopping my foot off. This was back when it wasn't happening. Did it as a joke.
Mm.
And she's like, no, you're kidding. I kept going until she believed me. Like, no, I'm joking. So to then have to call her and be like, I'm not kidding, but it's actually going to happen now, was that was like my worst one.
But was she pushing against it because how you're bullshitting to her in the past? Or
Yeah. And I was, but the best thing that I did do was right then and there in that appointment, I signed the paperwork to say, yep, go ahead with the surgery. They scanned it to me.
To go ahead with the amputation.
Yeah. They had scanned it to me within an hour. So I was like, I have the proof actually. And I screenshotted that paperwork and I was like, there you go, I signed it.
Oh,
like,
you sent it to her. Yeah.
But yeah.
So, and like, did you think, like, you know, like leading up to it, like, once the surgery's done, like, how am I going to feel? What's phantom pain? What do they even do with my leg once it's cut off? Like, what?
Yeah.
So when you're laying there before they bring the surgical team in to run you through the process and the anaesthetist and all the other components, clinical nurses and everything, like, what was racing through, and were you pretty anxious? Like, how were you?
I started to get very anxious. And more so not what was going to happen or the procedure, I guess more so the result of it, I guess. I'd been on chemo for 3 months. I had just come off it. Basically, I was thinking, what if I die in that procedure?
And did they explain that to you, like the
risk? Not really. They basically just said, obviously, there is a risk, but you'll be fine. And I knew I'd be fine. But I guess that was more so my worry. And I guess leaving, I just kept picturing, like, oh, like, what if I have to leave my nieces and nephews and all that sort of stuff. So the night before, I think it was like 12, I had sort of written in my notes everything that I wanted to happen. I had actually planned my funeral. I was like, this is the song, this is what I'm going to be dressed in. Just that was the one thing that I wanted, again, I wanted to be in control of. I had sent that file to my sister and I said, don't open it unless I die. I was like, but this is what you need to do if it goes. And yeah, that was sort of more so, I guess, that little prep that I did do prior. I was okay with it, actually. I was fine. I did get anxious going in because, again, it was more so, what if I do die? And to have a limb chopped off, like, you're kind of my head, like, that's crazy. Like,
pretty serious, yeah.
I just never thought I would be here. And then my sisters got there and my sister walked in and goes, oh, my ankle really hurts. Okay. So then that... we turned that into a big joke and that really calmed my nerves. And then I got wheeled out and they start off initially by just giving you an epidural. And they explained how they would do it, not in depth, but basically we'll cut all your nerve, like stop all your nerves so that your last memory in your brain is a happy memory and a pain-free memory. So we'll stop on the nerves, and then we'll start from the bottom and we'll just, go in.
Pretty serious.
And then that's pretty much all I remember.
And what's that?
That's pretty much all I remember just before it happened.
And waking up. So what would, obviously you would have been, still under pumped with a lot of drugs and, but as that you're waking up and that's wearing off and, you're looking down, and what was your first thoughts and feelings, and how was that process?
There was a few things. Waking up, so this is random, but this was my first thought. I'm pretty good friends with my former high school principal, so my old ex high school principal. I'm really good friends with her, and she had supported me a lot. And she said to me a couple of days, I won't ring you, I won't text you, you'll be drugged off your face. I'm like, I'll be fine. And I was like, if I'm fine, I'm going to send you a photo with my finger up. So the second I woke up, I was like, I need to get my phone so I could text her with my finger up. So, and I woke up feeling quite fine.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my first one. Then my second thought was, imagine if they chopped the wrong leg and I become double.
Double, yeah, because you still have to get rid of the other one.
Yeah. So up in the room, a nurse has to stay with you for an hour. And so she was like, I didn't want to bring attention to the fact that I was going to be looking to make sure it was the right leg or anything like that. Like, I just didn't want to bring any attention.
Yeah.
So I thought in my head, oh, I'll just move the left foot. That's so smart. Getting that I had an epidural. So I went to move the left foot. I'm like, oh, fuck, I can't feel that. And so then I was like, slowly, like, trying to touch, like, I can't feel that leg. Then I remembered I had the epidural. I'm like, oh, maybe that's why. So I quickly checked to make sure I had the legs. And then my third thought was, I want Maccas and I'm starving. So I called my sisters.
Cheeseburgers.
Yeah, they were staying quite close. And I knew if I said to them, can you get me Maccas? They're going to be like, no. Because they're like, you won't eat. So I was like, oh, you need to get here. So they ran there. And I was like, oh, I just want Maccas. but yeah, that was really my first three thoughts upon waking up. That was really all. I didn't go into any sort of grief about the leg, I guess.
Yeah, because that's what I was going to ask, the mental aspect of it after it. So, because mentally, that's pretty tricky, you know?
I can see how people go down that path. And I get it. But I never went through it. I guess I was more sort of, rather than being sort of reactive, or which is totally okay.
Right? Well, that's it. Everybody deals with it, you know, in different ways. Like, to do with acquired injuries or disabilities, or, you know, whether they're
anyone different. Like,
that's right.
Everyone differently. And that's okay. So even if I did go down that path, that's fine. Because if that's how we grieve, that's how we grieve and that sort of stuff. But I guess rather than in my brain, for me, I was like, all right, instead of sitting here and dwelling on it, what am I going to do? And what am I, just like, what am I going to do next? And you have people constantly in your ear. You're not going to be able to do this. You can't do this. We're going to have to teach you how to do this.
Yeah.
Every time it's just like,
all the can'ts. It's like, but you know, what about what I can do, not what I can't do?
Yeah.
Find an ability within your disability. That's what it's all about.
And I guess they do that to sort of prepare you for how you will be. But basically,
Because they don't want to be pissing in your pocket either, just telling you, you know, bullshitting to you. So you get out into the open environment and you think you might be able to do it. That's right. They got to be realistic. So,
and I guess whenever you go through someone having acquiring that disability, especially going into it, like really just knowing what's going to happen.
That's right.
They're not going to sugarcoat it. And a lot of people do go downhill. So I guess they still need to prepare you for what can be thought or looked at as a shit time and a shit path before you go down that.
Yeah. And did you have anybody, like, because you said you reached out to people that had gone through similar circumstances. Was there anybody that was going along the journey with you when you first initially had the surgery? Or
no, because I also am like, was a bit closed off. I didn't want.
Okay.
I didn't. I don't know. I guess there was some sort of not shame, or just I didn't want the attention, and I didn't want people to think that I was having a hard time or I wasn't going to cope with it because I was fine.
Didn't want that sort of like pity and all that sort of.
I didn't want that. Yeah.
Yep. Hearing.
And I knew that was going to happen, but. Because I felt fine and I felt so fine, I didn't, I just didn't want it. So I didn't go too much. I just did like little messages back and forth with people, but I didn't give them like too much, like, oh, what's about to happen to me, or, you know, and again, every experience is different. So they could have had a horrible experience where they didn't know what was going to happen, and then they went through a really bad time to cope with the grief and the trauma of losing their leg, or, you know, maybe waking up and not knowing it's gone and then being told it's gone. So different circumstances, I guess, with different, with some of the different people I reached out to. So, 100%. Yeah. And yeah.
So, because the next step is always rehabilitation. So obviously, you know, leg's gone, righto. So how do I cope? You know, is it for, you know, sitting in a wheelchair, obviously getting around because they've got to make up certain prosthetics, and then obviously learning, you know, getting those molds right and getting up and walking. So what were those stages and how'd that feel? But what was your thought process of where you had to be? Because obviously they would have told you, yeah, like with rehab and what's involved, and where were your thoughts of where you wanted to be at that stage?
Every time they told me what the standard procedure is, I would never say it, but in my head, I'm like, piss off, I'll show you. So I was sort of like, don't tell me what my process is going to be like, because you don't know.
It's like, I'm going to be setting the bar.
Exactly. And I was like, you're not going to tell me, I'm going to tell you. but a part of that was, and I was fully aware of it, I knew I was so fit, and I knew that I would probably, well, I was hoping I would cope with it pretty well. So the procedure starts off the following day. So a prosthetist comes up and puts a cast over your leg to stop further swelling. So your leg gets used to having something around it, because realistically in the morning you wake up, you're going to be wearing something around your leg for 12, 15 hours, taking it off at the end of the day. So he's like, we're going to start to prepare you. This is how we do it. So the cast goes on the next day.
And that's interesting, just so that the body actually gets used to having something on. It's like almost like a heavy, muscle memory thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, having all that weight on the prosthetic. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, again, still had an epidural. And you had to keep your leg straight, because if you bent it at the knee, your hamstring would tighten. And then you would have to go through the process of re-stretching your hamstring before you can walk. Sitting in the bed basically like this for 3 days. Got to day three. So it happened on Tuesday, got to Friday. It's like, I'm over this. So I argued with the doctors and the surgeons all day. I said, you're taking this shit out and you're taking the epidural. I don't want it. And they're like, no. Finally got to the agreement on Friday night. They're like, all right, we'll turn the epidural off. We'll just keep it in. We'll turn it off. See how you go overnight. Then we'll pull it out. Turned it off and I have not had pain since.
Really?
3 days after. So they turned it off. I did not take anything. They were waking me up every 4 hours. Do you want this? I'm like, no. They're like, are you sure? I'm like, well, I have no pain. So why would I take it?
Yeah. Then your opiates, whatever, get the shit away from me.
Yeah. So they pulled the epidural out on Saturday morning.
That's solid, brother.
Yeah. And then pulled it out, basically said I can't get up and do anything until I have an OT come through and guide me through it. I was like, I'll show you. So they all left.
And what hospital and rehabilitation unit were you in?
St. Vincent's in Melbourne.
Okay.
Yeah. So when they left, I locked the door and I went and had a shower. So I went and hopped up and had a shower. So it was quite, you know, that was sort of my first steps. Then they assess you on crutches and everything, and that was fine.
But how'd that fit? Like, okay, epidural, you don't want to take pain meds, opiates, whatever it may be, but, and getting feeling back. So your drugs are wearing off. So what did that feel like with the leg that had?
Well, I had no pain. It didn't actually feel like anything. It just feels like it is today.
So you don't get phantom pain, do you, or what?
Very, very rarely. So okay. Going through that whole process back then, I had phantom pain. I really wanted to stretch my toes out. That was the feeling I was having. And I'm like, I want to stretch them out. Obviously, the OT gives you so much support for that.
Mm-hmm.
I, again, the person I am, piss off. Like, I'm not listening. I read through her stuff, what she gave me and what she told me. And
right.
I just distracted myself. So I'd get a phantom pain. I'm like, it's all in my brain. So if I distract myself, I'm going to forget about it, basically. And that's what I did every time. And then a minute later, the phantom pain would go. Now I can, if I want to have phantom pain, I can bring it on. So right now I'm moving my toes.
The mind's a powerful thing, brother.
It is.
Mm.
Or every now and then I might be, you know, it actually happened last night. I just got to shoot up the heel of some pain, and that's, yeah, I don't get anything else at all.
So how long did it take before you know, they're getting the prosthetic on? Yeah. And you're learning how to walk and balance. Like, talk us through that. So how'd that go?
So generally the standard procedure is a week after the amputation, they send you to rehab. They reteach you how to be mobile on one leg. And also the balance, because of what I figured out later on, because I had shifted all my balance to my left side. When I got the prosthetic, I really had to realign my whole body and my diaphragm back because I got so used to being on the left. But same procedures, I send you to rehab for a week. Oh, no, a week after, you stay in rehab. You need to wait 3 weeks for the wound to heal. Once the wound heals, they can give you a prosthetic. So I went to the rehab a week after. I stayed a night. They sent me home. They said basically...
Hold on. How long?
A week after the amputation.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They sent me home. There's like, they basically... There was no reason for me to be there. I wasn't in pain and I was mobile. So they're like, there's no reason for you to be here. Go home. Let the wound heal. And come back.
So were you in a wheelchair or you had something that like to stand on or?
Yeah, well, I had crutches and I had a wheelchair.
Okay.
So my basic mobility, like every day, was the crutches.
Mm-hmm.
But then if I was going, you know, like.
Standard crutches or Canadian crutches?
Under the shoulder. Yeah. I had both, but I preferred the shoulder ones because then I could sort of.
Yeah, you can put a hand out and grab stuff.
And I had a wheelchair, but I didn't really use the wheelchair because I'd rather be more mobile and be able to move more about, unless like I was doing something that had to be on the crutches for a long time. I was like, I don't want to do that. I'd use the wheelchair. But again, when I went home, I was only home for really 2 weeks before I went back. So, I come home after that first week. I went back to CrossFit in that time while the wound was healing.
What?
Yeah. I was bored at home. Yeah. And I felt fine. And I was like, let's just go see what it's like to train with one leg.
At the end of the day, you know your limits. And like you said, you're in hospital telling them to piss off and, you know, you're setting your standards, you're setting your bar. So, you know, physically and mentally where you can just push. So, boom, CrossFit.
Yeah.
So a week after surgery or not even, so you're getting them into that. What do you put it? How do you say it? Wad life, yeah?
Yeah, that's it. I was getting that wad in 10 days after. So I did that 2.5 weeks. I got cleared for the prosthetic.
Yeah.
So you go, because I lived 2.5 hours away from Melbourne, just wasn't able to, I had to be an inpatient. And basically I got the prosthetic fitted. Probably took maybe 4 days to really feel comfortable, like the confidence to put your weight on that.
Mm.
That's what I really sort of struggled with. And, you know, it's quite uncomfortable at the start.
And you're 6'4", so you got, you know, you're coming from a bit of a height there if you're going to be hitting the pavement. So
exactly, like standing back up was like, whoa. Even for them to try and get the height right, like that took a while because I am so tall.
Yeah. Is that tricky? Like, because you're like, I'm probably losing half a centimeter to this side here. Yeah. I'm a bit out. So
get it right. Yeah. You go through. Now it's easy because they compare off my other prosthetics. If I was to, like, say, build a whole new leg. But yeah, so they. It took a while to get the height right because then you would step and you're like, I feel like I'm about to fall down, and then you come back up. But it probably took about 5 days. Once I really got confident and, you know, initially I started walking like my hips, so I wouldn't bend the knee because that's how I felt like I had to walk. I remember my physio was like, what are you doing? I'm like, I don't know. It's just like, bend your knee, mate. The second she said bend your knee, I took off. So right. I probably only actually did a 1 week of like the walking rehab, because then when I figured out how to walk and felt confident in that week, I was like, I'm not going anymore. And in that rehab, I got put back on chemo. So again, I'd fall into a depressive state. But it also didn't help that I was surrounded by nothing but elderly people that were in there for rehab.
So the doctors were like, just in case it had traveled up into your bone somewhere else. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was on chemo for another 6 months.
6 months.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that would have knocked you about physically and mentally. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. That was like the hardest thing. I didn't care about the leg. It was just like the chemo. Like, I just want this to be over. I kept saying, I'm like, turn the freaking thing off. Like, let me go. So in that rehab during that time, oh, I had no motivation. The only thing that the physios really made me do was go play Wii Fit at 2:30 every day, because that would make you, you know,
swing in the remoter, yeah.
Yeah, and do things that you wouldn't be thinking about, so you do things naturally.
Yeah.
So I did that, and then I enjoyed it because, again, I was surrounded by older people, and I would win. So I would really go there to win Wii Fit. That's all I did. So I was there for 3 weeks and went home with the prosthetic.
So was that your final prosthetic, or the final leg that you were comfortable with?
Yeah, no.
Okay.
So the very first leg that they give you is just like a standard one that they have there. Very heavy as well. So it's like a very old leg. They give you that, then they order your own. Then they send you off with a sort of more newer one. So I remember even transitioning from the first one that they gave me to the new one took a couple of days because it was so light compared to the other one. The other one was like, I don't know.
So was it a temporary, or had there been X amount of amputees that used the same leg?
Yeah, yeah. But obviously the socket's for your leg. But that's they would have used, and then they order you one while you're there.
Right, so it was a bit of a story to that old leg.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder who's... it actually was.
Yeah.
But so when I transitioned to the new one, again, it took me a couple of days because it was so much lighter, significantly lighter than the other one. So even when I started walking, it was like the leg was going to fly off because I was kicking so hard. But and then so you take that home, and then that's when you go into, you know, you get NDIS, and then you sort out where you go to from there.
Awesome. Yeah, because I want to get that NDIS. That's important. So with the leg, so is it a carbon fiber rig, or what is it that you've got?
What I have now, no. So I have a few different legs.
Mm.
So my everyday one, sort of like, it's not carbon fiber, like the sockets. I keep looking at it so I can, even though I look at it every day.
Yeah.
The socket is carbon fiber, and then it goes, I can show you. So I'll just take it off.
Well, that's it. Get it out. Let's have a look. Beauty.
So like, that's your leg.
Yeah, okay.
And then so you have that's just for height, really, and then you have sort of like this carbon fiber foot here.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and then here again, that is a pump. So this pump,
what?
This pump maintains the air in your socket.
Ah, so it's soft around your limb.
No, so it's no? airtight. So it's airtight, and it stops the fluctuation of the mass in your leg.
Right. Okay, that's interesting. That makes sense. Makes sense. Yeah.
So that you don't lose mass, really. And like,
does it provide comfort as well, or no?
Yeah, it's fully like it's comfortable.
I mean, like with the air, is it soft? Like it's a soft recess inside the socket?
No, it just secures the air, so it doesn't like pump as I go. It presses here, but it doesn't like pump in and out or anything. It just makes sure that it's like fully stable.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And yeah, so really, that's it. The first one I had, so this one, I guess you can see.
When you step,
It's soft here and then it goes, whereas the first one wasn't soft, so you would have to create that whole movement.
Yeah, okay, I'll get it. Yeah.
So this is my everyday one. This isn't the very first one. I got this one again.
Yeah.
Went on to NDIS. Then I have a waterproof one, which
nice.
They move different. I hate that one. So I have that one, spare one. Now, I have.
Do you have any specialty ones? Like if it's got to do with swimming or other aspects like that?
Yeah. Now, swimming, you would swim with no leg. But if I went to like the river or the beach and wanted to walk in the water, I'd wear the waterproof one.
Okay. No worries. Yeah.
Cycling, I'm about to use my spare leg. And what they do is they'll build it down from the socket and just put the cleat on the end instead of having a foot. So you go straight onto the pedal, into the cleat. I sort of have a running blade, but that's a lot.
So you've given that a crack, yeah, getting on the blade?
Yeah. So at the moment I have I purchased one. It's becoming a bit of a legal battle. So basically, long story short, I was seeing this other provider, wasn't happy with them, changed midway, but they had to complete the blade.
Right.
The blade, there's a whole process when you make a blade. So it has to be higher than your other leg to allow for compression, like significantly higher. It has to be set onto the back of the socket so it comes out instead of posteriorly. So the blade, instead of being you can have them attached here, but they will build them attached exteriorly.
Yeah, right. Okay.
It never felt right the whole time, and I told them that, and they just kept blaming it on my poor hip strength. So I took it to my new provider. She basically deemed it unusable, as they really just made like it's pretty crap.
Well, they done a dodgy on you.
Yeah, pretty much. They didn't know what they were doing, which they should have said. That's what we've come to, because they actually ended up cutting the blade way too short. That you can't get height back on a blade, so it's actually unusable. So I went through NDIS and everything. I'm like, well, what do I do about this? I have to ask for a refund, which I did. And they didn't get back to me. They got their lawyers to get back to me. Because the blade's not cheap. It's 15K.
I was going to say, yeah, because that's, you know, it's a niche.
And NDIS... like they weren't providing the full amount of funding, because because it's only been 2 years and
how'd that go? When did that come in for yourself? So you've come in, you've had the amputation, you've gone home, you're starting to regulate with life again. So when did the NDIS reach out? Did you have someone help you transition onto the NDIS, or how did that
go about? Me, because I was pretty knowledgeable at the time with NDIS. So I had I used to work in a specialist school. I was working in a specialist school at the time.
Oh, so you're already aware of the scheme itself.
And okay. I was a provider as well for the kids. I had my own business.
Yeah, nice. Okay.
So I knew I'd been to multiple planning meetings and all that sort of stuff. So I was very up with it. So I actually called them before I had the amputation and got an
access. Got the ball rolling. That's smart. That's smart.
It was going to take ages. So I reckon I had So I would have had the amputation done in July, August. November, I had my first planning meeting. So I...
No mucking about.
I really went in for it and they were good. They didn't muck around. Yeah. I reckon I had my planning meeting in October. I got the funds in November.
Nice. Yeah. And so National Disability Insurance Scheme.
Yeah.
That's what you're on. So how is that? Like, how was it back then when you first got on it? Because, you know, you've been an amputee for a while now, and obviously you're going through some debacles with, you know, the blades and whatnot and different providers. But how's the NDIS in general working out for yourself?
I found it really helpful.
It's great. And
supportive. My LAC, who does all my planning, is the best. She's so, so nice. And
shout out.
Yeah, Tracy. Awesome. Yeah. And, you know, back then, so we'll just jump in somewhere else, but I actually ended up getting a staph infection.
Oh, after I had the problem, so bad.
I don't know how I survived it because.
That's it, they can kill you.
Nearly did because I waited. I didn't go to the hospital. It was on my last round of chemo. And I was like, I'll be right.
And then that's hard too because your immune system's down because of the chemo. So
exactly. Got into the bone, so I had to have another two surgeries. They had to go in. The first surgery was to clean the leg out.
What? Because of the staph got up in there, yeah, and had to clean it out? Jesus, yep. Christ, right.
Then they had to go in the day after and shave some of the bone off because it got into the bone. So around my planning meeting, I was having a lot of issues and stuff.
Then just a bit.
Just a bit. And then so I had to get all my sockets changed because I lost the centimetre on the leg. And, yeah, so I lost my prosthetic for a month, which was
the
hardest thing, you know, having everything back and then it taken away. But in that time, you know, with my NDIS plan, I'm able to have a cleaner and a gardener to do those things that I couldn't do back then. But I also still have them now, which is quite, I guess I'm lucky.
No, well, it's great, yeah. You know, because at the end of the day, that's what it's designed for. It's exactly. Helping out people with disability and things that you, and, you know, having an acquired disability.
Hmm.
And that's what it's about. It's having those functions in place that with things that you used to do. And, yeah, you still want to do
again,
this stuff and be independent. But, you know, if you can't get, you know, to mow a lawn or whatever it may
that's
be.
Right.
And
yeah.
I don't know if you're living on a hillside or even if it's a
patch.
But at the end of the day, it's having this stuff.
And again, there are days where, you know, you might get a pressure sore. I can't walk. So I can't clean or I can't mow. And
see?
When I say, you know, I'm lucky because I am. And in the grand scheme of things, you know, I might go a week without walking sometimes. Now it's settled down now that I have a new prosthetic provider. But, you know, back then it was just like the fear of the unknown. And, yeah.
That's always the case, hey?
Yeah.
And that's the thing too. Like you could have, like with these, the mob that are making up the prosthetics, like if they're green, don't know what they're doing and, like if they make it like a little bit out of whack, that can create pressure areas, yeah?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Anything can. You lose weight, it might change the shape of your leg. So then it changes the shape of your socket. Or you put on weight, you can't get in it.
So many variables.
It is, yeah. It's like it's not just like a one size fits all or let's just do a socket and that'll last the year. It's not going to last a year.
Yeah. But, mate, it's good to know that the NDIS, the National Disability Insurance Scheme, is working for you. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
That's, you know, that's what you'd want at the end of the day and making sure that. Well, if you'd worked in it, you know how the scheme works and how tricky the navigation process and just the whole kit and caboodle can be. I'm glad that it's working out for you, brother. So
yeah,
NDIS and the big component within the NDIS is, you know, the letter D, disability. So being a part of that community now, how do you feel that being a part of this wide spectrum of people with disability and being amongst that, and just how you feel, you know, in general, and, you know, where it's the, you know, the highs, lows, the in-betweens, like, tell us about that.
Okay. Now, initially at the start, especially the word disabled, I guess it has some, it does have such a negative connotation to it. Do I think it does now? No. At the start, that was what I struggled with. And probably my identity, because I lived in a small country town, and everyone knew me. So it wasn't like I could just go under the radar. So having that physical and visual change was something that I struggled with, especially when I went back to work. I remember the first day I wore pants. I worked at a school. I didn't want the kids to see it. Of course they wanted to see it, but for a little bit, I did wear pants. And if I went to the supermarket, or even if people said the word disabled, I'm like, I'm more abled than you. That was what I struggled with at the start.
Ableism.
Yeah, exactly. And again, same as ableism, comes from being ignorant. And that's not a bad thing. It's just that there is no representation and there is no education about these things.
Mm.
So, yes, I was very ignorant at the start and challenged that word. But then I got to a point where, all right, what am I doing here? I am disabled. Disabled isn't a bad thing. That's basically it's just the term. Mm. Has a negative connotation. I want to change it. I don't want it to be viewed negatively. So then I had the acceptance of, I am disabled. This is what my life is like now. So stop trying to challenge it or say that you're not, or it's not going to happen. Mm. So yeah, I went through the acceptance, and now I'm grateful to be a part of it. And amongst that process and that change, especially working at a specialist school, you know, I would think about what they would say, some of the older ones.
What perspective did that give you? Because that would have given you a different outlook.
Initially, I didn't think about it because I was great yourself. And then, I don't know, there was just like this day or some sort of change when I did accept it. And I thought, well, no. Even though they didn't have, you know, prosthetics, they had different types of disabilities, they didn't feel like they didn't fit. And that's how I feel. I don't want them to feel like that. I don't want to feel like that. So if I can be in a position where I can change those thoughts and those feelings and that term, or the, change it from some sort of negative to a positive, I'm going to do it. And thinking about even now, back then when I was, you know, able-bodied, or I would say an ableist, like, because I was ignorant and, you know.
It's the same. I say the same thing, you know, when I was able-bodied, you know, it is what it is.
Because you don't think about it. And I guess there is no reason to think about it. But there is now, but you know what I mean? Mm. Like, because you're not being exposed to it, or there's no one to sort of stand up and represent or anything like that. Like, even going through the process, I had no representation and I had no one that I could, yes, I seeked people, but I found that difficult because I'm like, I don't want to be vulnerable and I don't want to open up to someone just because, you know, they might be missing a limb just like I am. So, you know, back then when I was working with those children, you know, they would say they just want to feel the same and they don't want to be excluded. And, you know, I'm not like everyone else. So back then it was heartbreaking, but then more so when I went through that change myself, and being from someone who was able-bodied and a very confident person to then someone who sort of hid themselves for a little bit and then went through that change, I think I'm more confident than ever.
Yeah, brother, can see it. When you're talking about change and, you know, showing who you are and, you know, because you're talking about wearing pants, but now, like, you're into this modeling game, man, you're getting this leg out on show. So where'd that come into the equation, like, with modeling?
Yeah, so random. My friend, she owns a clothing shop here. And basically what they were doing a couple of years ago was they were just doing some shoots to sort of promote their clothing line a bit more. And they were launching online. So they just wanted a variety of different things. And my friend messaged me. We hadn't been friends for long. And she messaged me and told me that's what they were doing. She said, I couldn't think of anyone else hot, so do you want to come do it? And I don't think of myself that way. That was just her message. And I was like, okay, sure. So it started off not about...
Nah, come on, you're like, yeah, bonus. No,
tell me again. What'd you say? No.
Yeah.
And so it started off nothing to do with the leg. And then, so I did that. And then from there, that sort of just got some, a little bit of exposure. And then I got some paid work. And then I was like, this is like,
that's awesome.
A little bit of a thing.
Yep.
And then I did some campaigns, I did some foundations, and then it agency reached out to me, and then it sort of just like kept growing and growing. So yeah, that's really how it happened. And again, in through that was, I guess, also the just after the same time I had really accepted myself.
Mm.
I had met other amputees from Peter McCallum who have just gone through the same thing. But again, it affects us differently. Some of them were really struggling and really trying to, couldn't deal with the fact that, or deal with the grief of losing their leg. So again, that was sort of like a push for me to think, all right, well, I can be in a position where I can make this representation and, yeah, provide that for other people.
That's solid, you know?
Yeah.
Being a, you know, stand-up representative for people with disability and, you know...
At the end of the day,
yeah,
anyone can become disabled. Like,
yeah.
And then you do... I don't want anyone to go through what I went through. Like, not that... I didn't think it was that bad, but... Why do you want to look at yourself differently and view yourself differently just because I lost a leg?
Mm.
Like, let's make this more represented. And so, you know, if that does happen to other people, they don't have to go through that.
Yeah. And how's it feel with the representation, especially like on the modeling front? Because you're exposing yourself. So you're showing, you know, not just you're showing who you are and, you know, where the legs are a component of you as a being and your disability. So how is that when you're thinking, where is that imagery going out? And, you know, what?
Yeah.
How's that
feel? Yeah, initially at the start, I was like, I don't want it to be about my leg.
Yeah.
And the jobs that I do get aren't about the leg, some of them, you know, so they're not all about the leg. But now as well, I'm in the other mind where I want it to be about the leg. I think I've had nothing but positive experiences to, I guess, where the images are shown and I am in control. So every contract, I make sure that I have a thing there where I tick the photos off before they're viewed, before they're released, just to make sure I don't want...
Mm.
You do get ugly pictures and, or, you know, you sometimes...
don't approve, take it down.
Exactly. Sometimes a... You know, I did one a while ago with the company, and the ones that they were sent through, the ones that they wanted to use, like, you want to use that? Mm. Like, why?
Yeah, but
Yeah,
that's awesome, brother. And so, modeling, but so is this WOD life still going on, or are you getting into a bit of triathlons, or what's the go?
So just before I lost
and fitness.
Yeah, just before I lost my leg, I started to consider and go down the path of I'm gonna do triathlons. And
So when it happened, really, I was just like, all right, now's the perfect time to do it. I don't do CrossFit as much as I was before. I do want to get back to that at some stage, but I was just having a lot of issues with my prosthetics until I got a new provider. So I would do CrossFit and I'd get a sore, can't walk for a couple of days.
I'll get
back to CrossFit and that at some stage. But yeah, so I reached out to some coaches and Triathlon Australia, I think like a month after it happened, because I was like, let's just like get the ball rolling. And, you know, I guess big picture, maybe Paralympics, that is in mind. And I do have a coach that's there at the moment, so that's very motivating. But bigger picture, yeah. Will I get there? Don't know. But if I...
You got 3 years. Come on, push.
I know. So I did last season.
No pressure.
Nah. Well, you need to put the pressure on. I normally don't say I want to go there. But it's a goal. But
if it's something that you can sort of hold in front of you and you know, if you get there or not, it's still something that you can push towards.
Yeah.
See,
and even if I really like triathlons now, and I did it last year without a running leg. I just ran on my walking leg. I was happy with that. So.
Yeah. Okay. And so how's it all going with COVID now? Well, you're down in Victoria. Like, it's pretty hardcore down there how's it going with exercise in general? You're still up around there?
Big New South, yeah. And I currently live in the New South Wales side. And when all this happened, Victoria got shut. So all of New South Wales was still open with like the gyms and the pools. So it was still fine for me.
Did it feel weird though? Like literally 10Ks or whatever over the border, everything's shut out?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Victoria would be shut, but Victorians would come to the gym here. Uh-huh. Like, yeah, I couldn't go to work because I'd have to work from home, but I can go here. Like if I just worked at a school here, I'd be able to go. So it was very weird, but at the end of the day, it was what it was. But now Victoria's in lockdown, New South Wales are in lockdown. So no gym, nowhere, I can't train, which is fine. I'm just sort of, it's only happened in the last week and a half. In the last week and a half, I become very unmotivated. I'm just like, meh, like, I don't want to train.
But you still be able to find stuff to do around, like out in the open.
I have stuff out the back that I can do. And so I will do that. Mm-hmm. I've got this trial loan running blade that I can use. So I need to continue to use that.
So how long is that going to take with the blade, you reckon?
To get my own or to run?
Both.
To run, I don't think it would take too long, probably like a month to two. But again, it's sort of hard to see some physios because of lockdown and COVID. But it's more so I need to get out on it.
Just getting a feel for it and knowing what speed you can get. If you're going to get into these triathlon, if you're going to be pushing for Paralympics, you got to.
I can run quite well on my walking leg even, but then run better on the blade. But I can do like a good 400 meters. But then my hamstrings and that just like tightens because I haven't done it for 2 years really. So the whole movement, my leg just fatigues and sort of like plonks out. So I'll rest for like 5 minutes and then I'll go again. So I really just need to spend so much more time on it to build that muscle memory back.
Right.
In terms of running, but I just don't do it. Like, I'm not going to lie. And so... to get my own running blade, that's sort of, then if it was my own, I would be more motivated. But now that I'm like, I have no idea when I'm going to get my own.
Yeah. So what's going on with that? Where's the blade? What's happening? Are you going to get your own or is it?
Well, I did have my own that I had to ask for a refund. And I'm protected by consumer laws. So sort of just going through that process.
So I did what I had to and did what I was told to do, which was ask for a refund. And the provider just got back with me, with a letter from their lawyer. So I don't know how this will play out. Later on today, I'm speaking with some Victorian Aboriginal Legal Services to sort of
ALS, yeah.
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 To assist me, just to give me some more sort of support. And sort of just so as I am protected. But now I am really sort of, all right, yes, it's happening to me, but I don't want that to happen to other people.
That's right.
You go through that.
100%.
Like, I'm not happy to go through it. I'll go through it, whatever. It's not happening to other people. So now I'm sort of seeking other, like I've made a formal complaint with NDIS because I want their registration to be taken off them.
Yeah. Well, you got a sense. Have you reached out to the Quality and Safeguards Commission?
I've not yet. I'm just
going to do that.
Just going to see. All right, I'll do that. Just going to see what they come back with from my response to the lawyer.
Yeah.
But I might do that anyways. In the meantime.
Name and shame and no, it's all good. Hold on.
I would.
No, it's all good.
I'm the legal battle that.
Oh, I know. I'm joking. It's all good.
I'll tell you when you stop recording.
Yeah. Awesome. But brother, you know, I really appreciate, you know, you coming on and just, you know, and just opening yourself right up because it's never an easy thing to do when you're talking about your childhood and where that led to, you know, mum passing away and then what you've gone through up until the age of, you know, 18 and living with family and then as an adult and then going through cancer and then chemo and then the amputation. But mate, look at what you're doing now and what you're striving towards when it's got to do with the Paralympics, which is an epic goal to hold in front. And mate, I hope that, you know, with COVID and everything, it's tricky, but I hope that, you know, there's ways and means around to do things. And I hope, you know, that can work out. And even if it's not the Paralympics, it's just, you know, getting in and doing triathlons here and there, because there's plenty of them for people with disabilities, which is awesome. But is there, like, you know, with your, if there's any shout outs or if there's, or your social media, handles, throw that out in the atmosphere, brother, if you want to,
yeah.
If people want to contact you.
Yeah. So my Instagram is James Parr. So JamesPARRR. That's probably my main one. I have a Facebook page, but I don't actually really use that. But, yeah, Instagram's probably my main one.
Instagram?
Yeah.
Awesome. Mate, appreciate it again. So you heard the man. And, hey, if there's any Radjuri mob out there that can help this fella reconnect, reach out to him. He's put out his Instagram handle. Have a yarn with him. And, mate, all best of luck in the future, especially with this blade thing. So
thank you. Any legal people listening? No, I'm kidding.
Reach out, help the farm.
Any lawyers?
That's it, bro. All right, you have a good one.
Thank you.
And talk later on, brother. Cheers. Have a good one.
Thank Cheers. You.
See, folks, perseverance. Despite his circumstance, it's moving onwards and upwards. Whether that's got to do with his modelling, general life, health and fitness, and I hope with having his sights on the Paralympics becomes a reality. Harris ain't too far away. Doing good work, brother. Keep it up. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe button. It'd be much appreciated. And we've also got a Patreon page. The link's within the description. Check it out, and if you want to become a part of the squad, that'd be awesome. And if you want to get in contact with me, you can get me via Instagram at StreetRollingCheetah or email one word StreetRollingCheetah@gmail.com. And we've also got a Facebook page, Keep Rolling with Jake Briggs, so check it out. And I want to thank our sponsors, Permanville Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here, and they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, we'll see you on the next one.